From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! A U.S. Marine is caught on camera shooting dead an unarmed and wounded Iraqi prisoner in a mosque in Fallujah. The Marine is heard on tape claiming the Iraqi was faking his death. Secretary of State Colin Powell announces his resignation along with three other cabinet members.
And after we had had a chance to have good and fulsome discussions on it, we came to mutual agreement that it would be appropriate for me to leave at this time.
And National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice is reportedly set to take his place. We'll look at the shakeup at the White House.
As she stumped for the president before the election, a lot of people wish she'd pay more attention to the nation's security than the security of her own job. But apparently it paid off. Condoleezza Rice's record of failing upward goes on.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Iraq, an NBC cameraman has caught on videotape a U.S. Marine shooting dead an unarmed and wounded Iraqi prisoner in a mosque in Fallujah. The NBC correspondent, Kevin Seitz, said the Iraqi man who was killed was one of five Iraqis who'd been injured after the U.S. raided a Fallujah mosque. Another 10 Iraqis had already been killed in the raid. A Marine can be heard saying on the pool footage provided to Reuters, quote, "He's faking he's dead. He's faking he's dead." The Marine then raises his rifle and fires into the man's head. I want to warn you, this is disturbing footage. The Marine involved in the shooting has been removed from the field and is being questioned by the U.S. military. The NBC correspondent on the scene said the shot prisoner, quote, did not appear to be armed or threatening in any way. The shooting came on the same day another U.S. soldier was charged with murder for the killing of an Iraqi detainee in Baghdad. In news from Washington, Secretary of State General Colin Powell has resigned. President Bush is expected to nominate National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice to fill the position as early as today. The move is expected to make the Bush administration more hawkish in its foreign policy. One of the chief neoconservative leaders of the nation, Gary Schmidt of the Project for the New American Century, praised the selection of Rice. Schmidt told the Washington Post, quote, "Condi knows what the president wants to accomplish and agrees with it." The Secretary General of the Arab League, Amr Moussa, told CNN last night that Powell was the, quote, voice of moderation in the Bush administration. While Powell's resignation was expected, the Washington Post is reporting that Powell's considered staying and had prepared a list of conditions under which he would be willing to stay. The list included, quote, greater engagement with Iran and a harder line with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. The Washington Post reports Powell was not asked to stay on board after he distributed his conditions for staying. Like Alberto Gonzalez, who's been tapped to serve as Attorney General, Condoleezza Rice is seen as extremely loyal to President Bush. The Bush administration is expected to nominate Rice's deputy, Stephen Hadley, to become the country's new national security advisor. In addition to Powell, Education Secretary Rod Page, Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman, and Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham all announced their resignations on Monday. In Iraq, the U.S. military is claiming it has secured Fallujah, but resistance continues to spread to other parts of the country. The Iraqi resistance launched attacks yesterday in Baquba, Mosul, Kirkuk, and Suwara. Police stations were stormed, oil wells were set ablaze, several suicide car bombings targeted U.S. troops. At least 50 Iraqis died in fighting across the country. In Baquba, the fighting was so intense, the U.S. dropped a pair of 500-pound bombs on the city, killing 20 people. In Mosul, the U.S. has diverted some 1,000 troops from the attack on Fallujah to fight the Iraqi resistance in this northern city. In Fallujah, the civilian death toll from the 8-day assault is still unknown. Yesterday, the U.S. military refused to allow an aid convoy from the Iraqi Red Crescent into Fallujah. The convoy was carrying food, water, and medical supplies. Even doctors inside Fallujah have said they could do little to help injured Iraqis because if they left their houses, they would be shot dead. One doctor told the Los Angeles Times, quote, "I saw the injured people in the street covered in blood, staggering, screaming, shouting, help, help, help me. But we could not get out and help them because we would be killed." Meanwhile, the U.S. military is now claiming it's captured just over 1,000 suspected insurgents in Fallujah, although the U.S. military has been claiming Fallujah was filled with foreign fighters. All but a dozen of the captured men are Iraqi. The New York Times is reporting nearly 2,000 former U.S. soldiers are resisting orders to return to duty. The military has sent notices to more than 4,000 former soldiers on the individual ready reserve. 1,800 of them have already requested exemptions or delays. Of the 2,500 who were supposed to attend training last week, over 700 did not show up. In news from Iran, the International Atomic Energy Agency reported Monday it's found no evidence that Iran had a nuclear weapons program, despite such claims by the Bush administration. In election news, the Green Party has announced it's raised $150,000 over the past week, enough to file the required fee for a statewide recount of the vote in Ohio. The Green Party and its 2004 nominee, David Cobb, have said the recount is needed because of widespread reports of voting problems in Ohio, including reports of mismarked and discarded ballots, problems with electronic voting machines, and the targeted disenfranchisement of African-American voters. Meanwhile, in electronic voting news, the Indiana TV station WTVW is reporting a recently uncovered electronic voting glitch has altered the results of the vote for the county commissioner's race in Indiana's Franklin County. The glitch caused some machines to record votes for Democratic candidates for Libertarians. When the votes were recounted after the glitch was uncovered, the Democratic candidate had won enough new votes to beat the Republican candidate who had been named the winner. In political news, President Bush has selected his former campaign manager, Ken Mellman, to be the new head of the Republican National Committee. Mellman's seen by many as a protege of presidential adviser Karl Rove. Meanwhile, independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader Monday called for the resignation of Terry McAuliffe, the head of the Democratic National Committee. Nader said, quote, "You've taken the Democratic base for granted, and as a result are losing support among Americans who should be supporting an alternative to the Republican Party." The Sunday Times of London is reporting it's obtained evidence that the U.S. government is leasing a special Gulfstream jet to transport detained suspects to other nations that routinely use torture in their prisons. Logs for the airplane show the Pentagon and CIA have used the plane more than 300 times and dropped off detainees in Syria, Egypt, and Uzbekistan.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. a world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain.
Bob Dylan, Masters of War, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Again, the news from Iraq, an NBC cameraman catching on videotape a U.S. Marine shooting dead an unarmed and wounded Iraqi prisoner in a mosque in Fallujah. The NBC correspondent is Kevin Seitz. He said the Iraqi man who was killed was one of five Iraqis who'd been injured after the U.S. raided a Fallujah mosque. Another 10 Iraqis had already been killed in the raid. The Marine can be heard saying on the pool footage provided to Reuters, quote, "He's faking his death. He's faking he's dead." The Marine then raises his rifle, firing into the man's head. Again, extremely disturbing footage. The Marine involved in the shooting has been removed from the field and was being questioned by the U.S. military. The NBC correspondent on the scene said that the prisoner, quote, did not appear to be armed or threatening in any way. The shooting came on the same day that another U.S. soldier was charged with murder for the killing of an Iraqi detainee in Baghdad. For quick comment, we turn now to the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Thank you, Amy.
Your response to this footage, to what happened?
Well, it's a war crime. It's a clear war crime. When you have the person who was on the ground lying there wounded is a protected person under the Geneva Convention. You can't harm a protected person. You can't execute them, obviously, once they're wounded and what they call hors de combat or outside, you know, they're no longer a combatant. So it's an execution. It's a violation of the Geneva Convention. It's a grave breach of the Geneva Convention. And what's most interesting about that, of course, is our U.S. law, our U.S. criminal statute, makes any grave breach of the convention a war crime under U.S. law that you can get life in jail and even the death penalty for. So it's a really serious crime. And, of course, one of my thoughts here is that this apparently was not the only person executed at that particular moment. There were a couple of other people, according to some articles I read today. And the other thing it raises is the fact that he was willing to do it in front of a cameraman, or apparently willing in some way. How widespread is this practice in Fallujah? Did they simply go in there and when people were wounded or when they were outside of combat, that they just murder them, and there's some evidence of that. I think you recall the story of a couple days ago when men, women, and children tried to get out of Fallujah, and they let the women and children go, and they forced the men back in, even though they had no weapons and they'd been tested for explosives, and there was nothing on them, and they forced them back in, and essentially into a killing field. So the whole question is here: is what we really did there? And it appears from this is a killing field in Fallujah.
Michael Ratner, we also have this report, Sunday Times of London, saying that it's obtained evidence that the U.S. government is leasing this special Gulfstream jet to transport detained suspects to other nations that routinely use torture. Pentagon, CIA sending using the plane some 300 times, dropping off detainees in Syria, Egypt, and Uzbekistan.
Well, there's two things about that. One is, of course, it's illegal under our own law for two reasons, both because we've signed the Convention Against Torture and implemented it, and it means you can't send people to a country where it's more likely than not they're going to be tortured. And we also have made that a criminal statute, a criminal violation, again, that you can be sentenced to very long sentences for sending someone to a place where they can be tortured. And in the particular case that the center is representing, Mahar Arar, who was the Canadian citizen who was sent to Syria for torture, interestingly enough, he was sent there on a Gulfstream jet, exactly like the one described in the Sunday Times, I guess it was the Times article in England. And the article said the jets actually left from Washington, D.C., and was interesting in Arar's case. He was first picked up on a plane in New Jersey, then flown to Washington, D.C., and then that plane eventually flew him to Jordan, where he was unloaded and taken into Syria, where he was tortured. So what's going on here is essentially a plane that's being used as an instrument of carrying people to their tortures, and it's a clear crime under U.S. law, but it's just additional evidence that the U.S. has gone off the page in terms of law and what it's willing to do to people.
Michael Ratner, president of Center for Constitutional Rights, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to Secretary of State General Colin Powell announcing his resignation. He's the top official to quit since President Bush's reelection as one of four cabinet resignations announced by the White House on Monday. The others include Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham, Agriculture Secretary Anne Veneman, and Education Secretary Rod Paige. So far, six members out of the 15 positions in the Bush cabinet have resigned so far. Today, we're going to spend the hour taking a look at this latest round of resignations. We begin with the most notable, Colin Powell. In a one-page resignation letter released by the White House, Powell wrote, quote, "I'm pleased to have been part of a team that launched the global war against terror, liberated the Afghan and Iraqi people, brought the attention of the world to the problem of proliferation, reaffirmed our alliances, adjusted the post-Cold War world, and undertook major initiatives to deal with the problem of poverty and disease in the developing world." After the White House made the announcement, Powell spoke to reporters in Washington.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As you know from the White House announcement earlier today, I submitted my resignation of Secretary of State as Secretary of State to President Bush on Friday. It has been my great honor and privilege to have been once again given the opportunity to serve my nation, and I will always treasure the 4 years that I have spent with President Bush and with the wonderful men and women of the Department of State. I think we've accomplished a great deal. My purpose here today is not to give you a listing of what we have done over the last 4 years, but to just take note of the fact that in recent weeks and months, President Bush and I have talked about foreign policy, and we've talked about what to do at the end of the first term. It has always been my intention that I would serve one term. And after we had had a chance to have good and fulsome discussions on it, we came to a mutual agreement that it would be appropriate for me to leave at this time.
Secretary of State Colin Powell speaking to reporters on Monday. Administration officials say National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, one of President Bush's trusted and closest confidants, will replace Colin Powell. Rice's deputy, Stephen Hadley, will replace her as National Security Advisor. An official announcement is expected later today. The Washington Post calls the cabinet shakeup, quote, the triumph of a hard-edged approach to diplomacy. Powell's a retired four-star general who rose to become the first African-American chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State. He developed what's known as the Powell Doctrine, using overwhelming force in military interventions. As head of the Joint Chiefs, Powell was the military architect of the 91 Persian Gulf War, a war in which Iraq's civilian infrastructure was systematically targeted. More than 100,000 Iraqis were killed. His turbulent 4 years as Secretary of State were marked by the September 11, 2001 attacks and the invasion of Iraq. Washington-based investigative journalist Bob Woodward has reported that in the run-up to the Iraq invasion, Powell was a lonely voice in the Bush administration counseling restraint and pursuit of diplomacy. His position reportedly put him at odds with other top administration officials, most notably Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. But in February 2003, it was Colin Powell who made the case for invading Iraq in an appearance before the United Nations Security Council. In his 70-minute presentation, he used satellite photographs, tapes of intercepted conversations between Iraqi military officers, and information from Iraqi defectors to argue that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Such weapons have not been found. This is an excerpt of Powell at the UN on February 5, 2003.
Our conservative estimate is that Iraq today has a stockpile of between 100 and 500 tons of chemical weapons agent. That is enough agent to fill 16,000 battlefield rockets. Even the low end of 100 tons of agent would enable Saddam Hussein to cause mass casualties across more than 100 square miles of territory, an area nearly five times the size of Manhattan. Let me remind you that of the 122-millimeter chemical warheads that the UN inspectors found recently, This discovery could very well be, as has been noted, the tip of a submerged iceberg. The question before us all, my friends, is when will we see the rest of the submerged iceberg? Saddam Hussein has chemical weapons. Saddam Hussein has used such weapons. And Saddam Hussein has no compunction about using them again against his neighbors and against his own people. And we have sources who tell us that he recently has authorized his field commanders to use them. He wouldn't be passing out the orders if he didn't have the weapons or the intent to use them.
Secretary of State Colin Powell addressing the United Nations, making the case for war, February 5th, 2003. When we come back, we'll be joined by several people to talk about Powell's record and also the ascension of Condoleezza Rice. Stay with us.
Why do your warships sail on my water? Why do your death bombs fall from my sky? Why do you burn my farm, my town down? I've got to know, friend, I've got to know why. Why do your ships haul death to my people? Nitro blockbusters, big cannons and guns. Why can't your ships haul food and some clothing? I've got to know, yes, I've got to know why. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around us. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know.
Paul Kamm and Eleanor MacDonald, I've Got to Know. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting on close to 300 radio and television stations, Pacifica stations and NPR stations, public access TV stations, as well as PBS, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Network's channel 9415 and 9410, Link TV and Free Speech TV, and on DirecTV, channel 375, Link TV. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue on the resignation of General Colin Powell as Secretary of State, we're joined right now by several people to talk about this resignation. We'll begin with Bill Fletcher. He's president of Trans Africa. Your response to the resignation and Secretary of State Colin Powell's record.
Amy, thanks for having me on the program. I have actually two immediate thoughts. One is that he should have resigned sooner. And the second is that this was an individual who had the one iota of credibility internationally and that is now gone from this administration. Powell was respected by many people, but the reality is that after February 2003, after his performance at the United Nations and after the revelations of the lack of weapons of mass destruction, his credibility plummeted. And at that point, people justifiably asked the question, why didn't he step down if he had been made to look the way he did? He then went on to engage in activities that helped in the ouster of President Aristide in Haiti, which, you know, was just was horrendous activity. So, you know, again, I ask the question, why didn't he resign earlier?
What is your response to those who say he was the moderate voice in the Bush administration?
I think it's like that song by Les McCann and Eddie Harris, Compared to What? I think that, you know, when we're talking about the real deal, yes, in a very right-wing administration, he probably was a more or less a voice of some level of moderation. But the moderation, we have to keep in mind, he was no dove. As you were talking about in terms of the 1991 Gulf War, the activities there and planning that out. But again, I keep coming back to Haiti. I mean, if this was a voice of moderation, why was he leading the charge, pushing President Aristide out the door? Why was he not instead using his office as a way of stabilizing the situation and bringing about peace. And I don't see that. I see something that was directly the opposite.
Bill Fletcher, president of TransAfrica. We're also joined by John Brady Kiesling, who spent 20 years in the U.S. Foreign Service before resigning his post on the eve of the invasion. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks very much.
Your response to the tenure of Colin Powell as Secretary of State?
Really disappointing. He should have been one of the greatest secretaries of all time. He's got the personal characteristics, the personal stature, the commitment to the job, basically the set of values to have been phenomenally successful, and perhaps working for a better president, he would have been that great one. But as it is, I agree that he should have resigned early.
Now, we have reports from the Washington Post of Colin Powell actually not necessarily wanting to resign. The Washington Post is reporting Powell considered staying and had prepared a list of conditions under which he would be willing to stay. The list included, quote, greater engagement with Iran and a harder line with the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Well, needless to say, at this point, Powell was not asked to stay on board after he distributed the conditions for staying. Your response to that, John Brady Kiesling?
That's very interesting. I hadn't heard. Thanks for telling me. It's quite characteristic, however. Colin Powell was not a successful fighter in the bureaucratic game of Washington. The only way that he could win battles was when he convinced the president, and his rivals in the process knew how to get around him and get the president to decide things before he was ever consulted. He found himself permanently playing catch-up with decisions already taken, and then feeling that as a team player, his job was to implement those decisions, even though he was in a position to know that the decisions were wrong, that they were detrimental to U.S. interests. And in that sense of being a team player, he did his country something of a disservice. Because fundamentally, when it comes down to it, the only part of the U.S. government whose job it is to understand the real world outside our borders is the State Department. If the State Department is not effectively communicating that real world to the rest of Washington, it might as well not exist. And unfortunately, though Powell, you know, personally did what he could, he was not effective enough at doing that job.
John Brady Kiesling spent 20 years in the U.S. Foreign Service in the State Department and quit under Colin Powell. We were not able to reach another one of the three high-profile resignations during the invasion, leading up to it and during. But I did get a chance to speak to Anne Wright, who had also worked in the State Department for many years, most recently serving in Mongolia. I caught up with her at the Democratic National Convention. It was an event of Women for Kerry, and she talked about why she had resigned.
Well, I wrote a letter, or sent by cable, a letter of resignation to Secretary of State Colin Powell.
And what did you say, and what was his response?
Well, I gave the reasons for my resignation. The first one was going to war in Iraq. The second one was that I felt that the Bush administration should have done more in resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that they should be doing more for resolving the North Korean situation. And I felt that the unnecessary curtailment of civil liberties under the Patriot Act was something that I couldn't live with and could not represent America as a diplomat with all of my concerns about the direction the administration was leading the country.
How did people respond to you, for example, in Mongolia? In Afghanistan, you opened the U.S. Embassy there.
Yes. Well, it was overwhelming. Within the first 3 days of my resignation, I had over 400 emails from colleagues in the State Department and colleagues that were in the diplomatic corps of other countries who had heard about my resignation and had taken the time to express their concern about the direction of American foreign policy. And expressed concern that I was resigning from the Foreign Service on one level, that they kindly said that they hated to see me go, but on the other side, that they were glad that I, along with two other people, had resigned to show that there was great concern within the ranks of the federal government about the direction of these policies.
What was the response of the Secretary of State, General Colin Powell?
Well, Secretary of State Powell did send a cable about 3 days, 4 days later, and it was short and sweet, but it kind of hit the high points. It said, I am sorry that you disagree with the policies of this administration, but I want to thank you for your service to our country, both in the diplomatic corps and in the military.
Former Army Colonel Ann Wright. She served in the Foreign Service for 16 years, most recently Deputy Chief of Mission in Mongolia, one of those who resigned under Colin Powell at the State Department. I wanted to ask Bill Fletcher, President of TransAfrica, I know you have to leave, but about the reports that, well, it looks like Condoleezza Rice will be named to replace Colin Powell. It was reported that she wanted to be the Defense Secretary with a much larger budget, but it does look like she will become Secretary of she will be nominated as Secretary of State. Your response?
Internally, for symbolic purposes, it's a very good move for President Bush. Substantively, it's a horrible move because we're now introducing someone who does not seem to have the capacity to listen and to consider alternative points of view. I've watched her in responding to interviews, congressional testimony, and what you don't get a sense of is any level of flexibility. She truly believes the dogma of the Bush administration unapologetically, and I think that from the standpoint of the world's peoples, we're looking at some very difficult times. I cannot imagine her helping to shift the United States from the bullying posture to any notion of global partnership.
John Brady Kiesling, your response. Did you have dealings with Condoleezza Rice in your time in the State Department?
Not directly, but I agree with the overall conclusion. Her job, as she saw it, was to make her president feel comfortable with the decisions that he was making, not to challenge him to think more deeply. The job of the Secretary of State is largely to go out and fight within the U.S. bureaucracy for the interests of our partners. If we do not do that, as well as fight for our own interests overseas, we find that the interests of our partners and broader, longer-term U.S. interests are sacrificed to American domestic politics. Powell made a reasonable effort and failed. I cannot imagine her making any effort at all.
Well, I want to thank you both, John Brady Kiesling and Bill Fletcher of TransAfrica, for joining us as we turn now to Laura Flanders, who has written a book about the Bush Women, the title of the book, Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species. I want to start, Laura, by talking about Condoleezza Rice. You have a chapter on her. And then we'll move on and talk about Ann Veneman, the Secretary of Agriculture, who left yesterday. But Condoleezza Rice.
Well, it's really fascinating. I mean, Colin Powell's departure speech that you quoted, where he talks about liberation, I mean, it'll come as news to a whole lot of people in Afghanistan and Iraq that they've been liberated in Fallujah. They seem to have been liberated from their lives. What has been liberated is the United States from the trammels of international law. And I think the appointment of Condoleezza Rice shows that there is no intention in this administration to remake the bonds or make new bridges between the United States and other countries. I mean, this is a character who is seen even more than Colin Powell as simply a client of George W. Bush, a crony of Bush's, somebody who's been working with Dick Cheney, Pearl, Wolfowitz, that whole crowd since the first Bush administration. If, as Bill Fletcher put it, Colin Powell had an iota of credibility internationally, which he squandered there at the United Nations, Condoleezza Rice doesn't even have that. And let's recall, this is the woman who, with respect to national security, we'd have to say failed. She told the hearings that, I don't remember al-Qaeda cells as being something we were told to do something about. She talked about the August 16th PDF, the presidential memo, bin Laden determined to attack within United States, as not warning of anything, and nothing that she felt any action had to be taken on account of. She going back to the first Bush administration, she was the Soviet expert who never saw the collapse of the Soviet Union happening. So does anybody in this country have any reason to feel more secure about our relations with the world with Condoleezza Rice heading up state? I don't think so. But I think it does send a very strong message that this administration intends to do nothing to alter what has become the rule of empire, which is one set of rules for the United States and another for the planet, and devil take the hindmost. Who cares?
Laura Flanders is author of Bushwoman, Tales of a Cynical Species, and also a radio talk show host on Air America on Saturdays and Sunday nights. Laura, in looking at Condoleezza Rice's ascension now, we see that George Bush is consolidating the loyal followers, the people who really insulate him. Your response to that?
Absolutely. I mean, along with Alberto Gonzalez, this is somebody who is has personally risen thanks to his sponsorship. And let's not forget, I mean, when we were thinking about checks and balances in this administration, when the Constitution thought that was a good idea, I don't think they were anticipating an advisor who literally sleeps in a cottage outside the president's ranch in Crawford, spends most weekends with the president and his wife, is somebody who has, as far as we can see, never actually stood up for the president, raised questions about international law, maybe behind the scenes, but nothing we've become aware of. Fascinatingly, she, unlike any other national security advisor in past administrations, went stumping for this president in the weeks, even days before this election. And people in Pittsburgh, for example, were astonished to hear her show up there just 12 days before the election, when Dick Cheney was talking about terrorists possibly using nukes on U.S. cities, and we were having, you know, the threat level raised to, I don't know, crimson or something. She was touring for the president, making political speeches, and when asked, she once again reiterated the line. She was asked in Pittsburgh, has the cost of the war been worth it? The invasion and occupation of Iraq, the $150 billion, whatever it is. And she made, again, the unproven allegation of a link between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, and said the circumstances in the Middle East that produced the attacks of 9/11 still exist, therefore we are obliged to act. This is not absorbing any of the information that has come to the world in the last 2 years since the invasion.
Well, yesterday's resignation of Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman, the first woman to hold the post, caught many in the farm community by surprise. As we move from Condoleezza Rice to Ann Veneman, she had campaigned feverishly for President Bush in key farm states in the run-up to the November 2nd election. At a teleconference with reporters last Tuesday, she sidestepped a question about her future, saying only that, quote, the president will be making decisions on personnel. But in a letter to Bush just 3 days later, she declared that, quote, now is an appropriate time for me to move on to new opportunities. Veneman's tenure spanned a tumultuous period that included the 2001 anthrax scare, the 2002 farm bill, major agriculture trade disputes with Europe, Asia, Brazil, what was presented as the first verified U.S. case of mad cow disease earlier this year. Among those mentioned yesterday as possible replacements, Alan Johnson, Chief White House Agriculture Trade Negotiator, Chuck Connor, Agricultural Advisor to the President, two Texans with long terms on the House Agriculture Committee, former Congressmember Larry Combest, and Congressmember Charles Stenholm, who was defeated this month in a bid for a 14th House term. What about Ann Veneman?
Well, Ann Veneman's another one who traveled the country handing out goodies immediately before the election, just weeks before the election this past November. She was in Columbus announcing a $207 million water cleanup project for Columbus, Ohio, which we know became, you know, the center of the disputed election. The USDA under Ann Veneman has basically been handed over to U.S. food and trade corporations. Her second in command is a man from the National Cattlemen's Association, a trade group for those who distribute our meat. Are they going to take very seriously the threat to our food supply? I don't think so. But Ann Veneman's been very convenient, very useful. When the mad cow disease scare hit, she went on television saying she, as a woman, was going to be feeding steak and, feeding steak, I think she said, to her family, at which point I pointed out at the time, as far as I could see, she only had a cat as family. But nonetheless, I mean, her use has been to reassure the public there's no reason to be concerned, even as the administration, the USDA, which is supposed to be an entity protecting the consumer's interest and the small farmer's interest, has been turned over to the largest corporations. And we just heard, as an almost parting note from Ann Veneman, that the news out of Iraq is that Paul Bremer's instructions have now changed the law, the regulations put into effect before the appointment of the new so-called independent government. The new laws around the use of seed in the birthplace of agriculture have been changed such that farmers can no longer use their seed that they've gathered from the year before and replant it as they have for millennia. Now they must buy that seed from the U.S. corporations that made Ann Veneman's career possible. On a personal note, she's been fighting breast cancer, and that may have something to do with her departure, but she is somebody who has rotated in and out of U.S. agriculture corporations, Monsanto, Cargill, and all the rest, and offices in public service, so-called. Whether she's been serving the public, I think, is hugely in dispute. She's been serving those who work for corporations.
John Stauber is also on the line with us. He is co-author of the book Mad Cow USA, and wrote Weapons of Mass Deception and Banana Republicans, along with his colleague Sheldon Rampton. He's executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy. And Veneman, your assessment of her as Laura talks about the corporate ties.
Well, first of all, it's great to be with both of you. Ann Veneman was certainly qualified to be Secretary of Agriculture if the qualification begins with a long history of serving agribusiness, and that seems to be the principal qualification in the U.S. For that position. She was on the board of Calgene, one of the earliest genetic engineering companies. She served as an undersecretary of agriculture, and she was very critical in that role in negotiating the free trade agreements, the GATT agreement and NAFTA in particular. And when the first U.S. mad cow was discovered and announced December 23rd last year, she came forward immediately and held a high-profile live national news conference, as Laura said, downplaying the risks and providing misinformation, saying that this was really nothing to be very concerned about, but whatever it took to fix the problem, she would pursue. Since then, in fact, virtually nothing has been done to address the reality of mad cow now infecting the U.S. meat supply. And I have to think that one of the major reasons for Ann Veneman leaving is that she was so successful in sweeping this issue under the rug, getting it off the TV screen, while actually doing little or nothing to address the problem, that she has to be well aware of how the mad cow issue is going to persist and grow worse and really bite whoever's in that position in the years ahead.
Laura Flanders, last comment.
The last comment is simply on the question of breast cancer. You know, all thoughts, of course, are with Ann Veneman as she fights a disease that plagues so many in our community. A lot of people believe that the very policies she's pursued, restricting regulation on pesticides and what we put on our food, is exacerbating the problem of breast cancer. So there's an irony there that I think is both sad and enraging, should be.
Well, I want to thank you, Laura Flanders, author of Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, and our America radio talk show host, Saturday and Sunday nights, the Laura Flanders Show. And also, John Stauber, thanks for being there, and your books, among them are Mad Cow USA. Thank you for being with us. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at the resignation of Spencer Abraham from the Department of Energy, and then finally Rod Paige as Secretary of the Department of Education leaving as well. Stay with us. Your heart.
God, let me watch you, please. Got no money, but everybody knows I love you, Condi, and I'll never let you go. Sweet and dandy, pretty as can be. You be the flower, I'll be the bumblebee. Oh, she loves me, oops, she loves me not. People say you're cold, but I think you're hot. Oh, Condi, Condi, oh, Condi, Condi.
Steve Earle, Condi Condi, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham resigned Monday after what many are calling a tenure marked by frustration. Many say his greatest disappointment is the administration's failure to win congressional approval of President Bush's high-priority energy bill, despite Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate. In a letter to President Bush on Monday, Abraham said he was submitting his resignation because he wants to devote more time to his family, including his three young children. He said he would remain at the department until a successor is confirmed early next year. As a Republican senator from Michigan, Abraham once called for dismantling the Energy Department. As Energy Secretary, Abraham faced a number of major issues during his tenure, from the nation's worst power blackout to record-high crude oil and gas prices, as well as a growing urgency to find a place to bury the country's nuclear waste. In his resignation letter, he also said 90% of the recommendations issued by Vice President Dick Cheney's 2001 Energy Task Force, those that didn't need legislation, had been implemented. Just before the program, we talked to Robert Kennedy Jr., author of the book Crimes Against Nature, How George W. Bush and His Corporate Pals Are Plundering the Country and Hijacking Our Democracy. We asked Bobby Kennedy to respond to Spencer Abraham's resignation.
Well, under Spencer Abraham's leadership, the Department of Energy was seemed to be more interested in serving big energy contributors from the oil and coal industry specifically, and from the nuclear energy industry, than serving the public interest. That industry contributed $48 million to President Bush and the Republican Party during the 2000 cycle, and after the inauguration, they donated another $58 million. And the energy policy, which was one of the first policy initiatives of this president, was hatched in 109 days of secret meetings with the CEOs and major lobbyists of those organizations, with the Dick Cheney's energy secret energy committee, which was staffed by Spencer Abrams, who was one of the guiding hands with Dick Cheney. Spencer Abrams had come out of the out of Michigan, where his relationship with the automobile industry had been a very, very close one, and he had been one of the champions of fighting CAFE standards, corporate average fuel efficiency standards in automobiles. And of course, you know, that is probably the principal reform that we need to do in our country if we're going to end our dependence on foreign oil. If we raise fuel efficiency by 1 mile per gallon, we generate twice the amount of oil that's in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. If we raise fuel efficiency by 7.6 miles per gallon, we could eliminate 100% of Gulf oil imports into this country. So we have a solution to our energy dependence, foreign energy dependence. But instead of taking that solution, the Abrams energy policy was to increase drilling, increase big tax breaks to these energy companies that were already rolling in record profits and didn't need extra public money. But it seemed he seemed intent on serving the interests of those companies rather than the American public. You know, and this is what we've seen across the board with this administration. This administration has more CEOs in its cabinet than any administration in history. It's really a merger of state and corporate power. And you see that not only at the secretariat levels, But in the subsecretariat and assistant secretariat and the agency heads, this administration has put lobbyists for the extractive industries and for the energy companies as heads of the agencies that are supposed to regulate those industries. The head of the Forest Service is a timber industry lobbyist. The Forest Service is part of the Department of Agriculture, where Ann Veneman reigned, and corporate agriculture was heavily represented in all the agencies. The head of public lands is a mining industry lobbyist who believes that public lands are unconstitutional. The head of the air division at EPA is a utility lobbyist who's represented nothing but the worst air polluters in America. The President Bush appointed a second command of EPA, a Monsanto lobbyist, and head Superfund, a woman whose last job was teaching corporate polluters how to evade Superfund. And if you look at virtually all of the subsecretariats in the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Energy, Interior, and even the Justice Department, they are now being run by, you know, these agencies that are meant to protect Americans from pollution are now being run by lobbyists for the worst polluters in our country. And it's not only an assault on the environment, because these, you know, companies are trying to liquidate our shared resources, our public trust resources, for cash and for their own profits, but ultimately it's an assault on democracy as well. We have been warned from the beginning of our national history by our greatest, most visionary political leaderships against the merger of state and corporate power. About the corrosive impacts of excessive corporate power on American democracy. Franklin or Teddy Roosevelt said, who's a Republican, said that our country would never be destroyed by a foreign enemy, but he warned that our democratic institutions would be subverted by malefactors of great wealth who would undermine them from within. Dwight Eisenhower, another great Republican, in his greatest speech ever, warned America against the domination by the military-industrial complex. And the greatest Republican in American history, Abraham Lincoln, said during the height of the Civil War in 1863, he said, "I have the South in front of me, and I have the bankers behind me. And for my country, I fear the bankers more." And, you know, there's nothing wrong with having business people in government if your object is to bring competence and expertise into the administrative process. But too often with this president, we've seen that these business people are not entering government for the public service, but rather to subvert the very laws they're now charged with enforcing.
Robert Kennedy, Spencer Abraham, as the one-term senator from Michigan, received more money from the automotive lobby than any sitting senator. And you still have, at least at this point, Andrew Card, chief of staff, who's a former General Motors lobbyist. How does that affect policy?
Well, again, you know, the keystone of national energy policy has to be fuel economy standards. But instead of trying to, you know, trying to improve fuel efficiency, this administration cut the tax breaks for hybrid cars, and they implemented a $100,000 tax break for the largest SUVs, for Hummers, essentially, so that you could get it can actually be, for some people, cheaper to buy a Hummer than it would be to buy, for example, a $22,000 Prius, simply because of this huge tax breaks that you can get that encourages people to buy the least fuel efficient cars. That's not a national energy policy. This administration really was not trying to conserve oil and our dependence on foreign oil. The major objective of its energy policy was to serve the interests of Detroit and the big oil companies. And the energy plan that was hatched by Spencer Abrams and Dick Cheney was written by the energy companies and was by a dream team of energy lobbyists who got together to do the bidding of the president's corporate paymasters in the energy industry.
Robert Kennedy Jr., author of the book Crimes Against Nature, How George W. Bush and His Corporate Pals Are Plundering the Country and Hijacking Our Democracy. He's with the Natural Resources Defense Council and head of the Environmental Litigation Clinic at Pace University in White Plains, New York. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to the resignation of Education Secretary Rod Paige. The reports began to emerge late last week that he wouldn't be around for a second Bush term. His tenure was defined by his defense of the No Child Left Behind Act, the biggest change in federal education policy in decades. He also attacked opponents of the act in terms that shocked some. He referred to the National Education Association as the country's largest teachers union as a terrorist organization for the way it opposed the law. Page apologized but maintained his criticism of the union, which called for him to resign. Rod Paige also pushed hard nationwide for controversial private school vouchers. We're joined now by Reg Weaver, the president of the National Education Association, the nation's largest teachers union with almost 3 million members. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you so much.
Well, you called for Rod Paige's resignation. He's done it. Your response?
Well, my response is that his leaving is not because of my calling for his resignation on February the 23rd. I had heard over 2 years ago, almost a year and a half ago, that he was going to be leaving. So I don't want to associate his leaving with my calling for his resigning on February 24th for calling us a terrorist organization.
Can you explain what your criticism of Rod Paige is and why he called you, your organization, a terrorist organization, which I guess makes you the chief terrorist?
Well, I'm not criticizing Rod Paige. I'm criticizing what Rod Paige said. And for anybody, Rod Paige or anybody else, to call an organization that represents 2.7 million members working with students every day, for anybody to call anybody in that group a terrorist is not nice. And during the time of this country, to have anybody to be called a name such as that, it really isn't nice. So that's over. And so what we want to do is continue to work to make sure that we have the opportunity to work with others to make sure that every child has a great public school.
What about the No Child Left Behind Act? Because that is left behind. That's in place right now.
Well, the No Child Left Behind Act, the goals of the law are good. Those are the goals that we have been supportive of for years. Standards and accountability that makes sense, and highly qualified teachers in every classroom, closing the achievement gap, those are good goals, and we support those. However, the way the law is currently crafted, it is practically impossible to implement, as states and locals have found. We believe that the law, number one, needs to be fully funded. Number two, we think that there needs to be more flexibility in the definition of adequate yearly progress. Number three, we believe that there needs to be flexibility in the definition of highly qualified teachers so that those who are, duly highly qualified and certified go into schools that are where they are needed. And four, we believe that support professionals, in order to have professional development opportunities, need to be able to take advantage of Title I funds. And number five, we believe that supplemental service providers ought to be those individuals that are highly qualified and certified. Additionally, we believe that once a school has been identified for needing assistance, then that school should be given the assistance. It should not be targeted and labeled as a failing school.
Reg Weaver, I want to thank you for being with us, president of the National Education Association, on the resignation of Rod Paige as education secretary. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. I'll be at the Judson Church in New York City tonight at 7 with Michael Massing, Laura Flanders, Howard Friel of the Paper of the Record. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.